Call to order. The Design Review Board meeting of 2 July 2025. Members present are Kit Austin, Herb Roth, and
Recording Tony, in progress.
Tony Grant. Online is Molly Egan. Is that true?
Nope,
no,
not yet.
Okay. First item on the agenda is DRB 250127, Prima Cornice LLC. The planner is Greg Roy. The applicant name is Prima Cornice LLC, represented by Collective Design.
Yes, I'm online, Herb, so it's Greg. Go ahead and share my screen. So the board has seen this application before. We were at the last DRB meeting with this one, and the board had some comments kind of on the exterior of the house, more on the rear, looking at all the windows and seeing if there was more balance that could be brought between the stone and the glass. So that is the application we're referring to today. The applicants have made some changes, and let me just go ahead and do a quick side-by-side to show you some of the changes that were made. So you can see here on the left was the previous application or previous proposal, and what is on the right here is the changes. The changes are really limited to the bottom level. So underneath that deck, those piers kind of holding up the deck were clad with the same stone that's on the house. And then a little bit more of the stone was added here to the hot tub kind of patio area. In the documents, they did provide a few different perspectives looking at the house from the different corners of the lot. So we can see here, looking at it from kind of the southwest of the lot itself, looking up towards the home, from directly lower on the lot, looking up towards the house as well, and then moving over to the right. These are certainly very helpful, but I do want to remind the board and the applicant, as far as the application itself, we're looking at four-sided architecture, and you know whether or not you can see it is not something that the board takes into consideration. Here is an alternative design option that was provided as well, looking at the house with a solid stone kind of bottom to that deck. If we continue through some of the provided materials from the applicant, looking at some real world pictures from the bottom of the road, looking up towards the lot. And again, this is, as you may know, a very steep lot looking up towards that area. So these were all in the packet as far as the documents. They did provide a few of the inspiration images as well. Here's an example of a house on Telluride that is very similar, that kind of provided some context or idea for the house itself, as well as one over on Beaver Dam, I believe it is. In the area, this lot is on the north side of Potato Patch, kind of adjacent to the home. This is one that has been there for quite some time, but certainly shares some of those similarities as far as the amount of windows in that area, with a little more stucco and a little more break between some of those windows is kind of what you're seeing here. It gets back into more of the images we saw last time at some of the adjacent houses. So let me kind of go back over the plans. This is that one elevation. And again, I think based on the last meeting, these were generally what the board had comments on, was this elevation. There wasn't a lot of discussion on other items. So really coming back to the board to kind of review this portion. Is there anything else that the board would like me to go to as far as plans on this part before we turn it over to the applicants?
No.
Okay.
No.
With that, I'll invite the Collective Design Group to kind of take it away.
Great, thank you. Zane Levin, Principal Architect of Collective Design. Here with the homeowners, future homeowners, and current homeowners in Vail. They wanted to kind of kick things off by saying a couple things, if they may, and then we'll turn it over to me and I'll talk about some of the updates and the conversations that we've had in the recent past since our last meeting.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
We are the Greenie family. Very happy to be here and meet all of you. I just wanted to introduce ourselves briefly before we talk about our design. My name is Lloyd. I'm a retired teacher. This is my husband, Jonathan, a snowboarder and an entrepreneur who loves the mountains, actually worships the mountains more accurately. We came here 3 years ago, and we live here full time now with our 12-year-old son, who's sitting way there in the back. He's lifting his hand right now. He's a student at HPS, Home State Peak. We love it here, and thank you for allowing us to be present here today.
Thank you, Ruth. My name is Jonathan. Thank you for volunteering and reviewing and doing this work and reviewing it's discreet, right? Although it's a neighborhood, you cannot really you get the sense of privacy while you're still there. But anyway, thank you for listening and thank you for reviewing. And Zane, I'll let you do your thing.
Yeah, great. I know sometimes you guys have the clicker to be able to flip through things. I don't know if with Greg being remote, if he can just control things, but...
Sure, tell me what page you want to go to and I'll move it along.
Fantastic. I think the most relevant part of our conversation today, I'll start with the updates that have been made since we all spoke last. We heard from you all that you wanted to see a bit more stone, a bit more of a grounded architecture, kind of correlating with the site. So we have... tried to do that with some of the stone around the base of the deck and the base of that lowest level. So that was a purposeful effort that has been made from y'all's comments. So thank you for those. Beyond that, what we really looked at a lot was we recognize that ultimately the board does review four-sided architecture, but with this unique lot, there's not a lot of lots that are this steep or in this position where the view angles of the home are not necessarily directly straight on. So we tried to represent that. So I don't know if we can go to some of the images, the renderings, if you will, of the lower angles from the low sides of the lot. We tried to represent what we feel the architecture will truly look like from a passerby. So when you're looking up at the home, we're taking into consideration that stone that we've added at the base, the wood soffits, and of course there's the glass, right? The glass, while not going to be reflective in nature or we're not allowed to have it too shiny or too reflective, it will have some sort of reflective nature, either up to the wood soffit or to the sky. And we think that that's a really nice balance of natural materials with the natural sort of sky. And the way that the home sits on the site, it is reflecting its natural surroundings. You're kind of looking up at it. It's sitting well on the site. It's not this massive obtrusive thing. It's tearing up the hillside. So our perspective, and we were trying to show you the same perspective, was that because of this site's unique kind of topographic nature, we really tried to design to cater to that. And then the windows really bring the life of the home's surroundings to fruition on the inside. When you experience that home and look out, similar to their inspiration, their neighbor's house, or some of the other inspirations, when you're inside that home looking out across the valley, that's what we were trying to capture with the architecture. So we're feeling like we're appreciative of the most recent comments, and we tried to capture those best we could. And we're feeling like the home is doing justice to this very unique and special site. Anything else you two would like to add?
Thank you.
Great. Happy to answer any questions as well.
Yeah, I have a question. So on the alternate design option with the retaining wall in front, that is not what you're proposing. That's just an alternate design. If it's just a option B, right?
That's correct. And the reason for that, we feel that the option A, we'll call it, is a better design, in that when you are looking up from the valley floor at the homes that exist there, a few of the homes have large, massive rock retaining walls. And it was comments by these two and by us that it really drew your eye up the hill, and you could see those kind of large retaining walls. So we were trying to diminish the component that would like draw your attention to it by doing what we've done with the stone bases at the columns. If you all felt that the architecture was more grounded with the alternative option B, I think that we would be open to that conversation. But we felt pretty strongly that option A was the better approach with the overall architecture that we've presented here.
I think I prefer option B.
I do.
Make
too.
It a little more grounded, and I not that those look bad. It just doesn't. I think it would look better. I like option B better. So
Understood. The one thing that you've left out in your presentation, in the some of the drawings show landscaping in front of that lower level. And is that the landscaping that's shown on the drawings, what you have now on the rendering?
I don't believe that it's a direct correlation of the drawings that we have in our landscape plan and these renderings. I think it's just representational of some generic landscaping.
Greg, could you go to page 4 of 37? Sorry, of the other attachment. Yeah, that one. So in that, I guess on the right hand side, are those are trees, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the rendering doesn't have trees in the back of the home.
We weren't planning to plant additional trees, and there aren't existing trees, at least not anything substantial, to the rear of the home. If you're talking about the site plan there,
yeah,
that represents more so shrubs and low bushes than large scale trees. So similar to the rendering, some low bushes and shrubs, those do correlate. I'm not going to sit here and say that the bushes you see in the rendering are in the exact within an inch location of what we've drawn in the plan, but they're representing a similar concept. Does that address your question, Tony?
Correct.
Any other questions? Any public comment? Anybody here?
If there's anyone in the room that wishes to give comment, please come forward. Otherwise, we'll ask anyone online to raise their hands. Right now, we have one attendee without their hand raised. So unless there's anyone else in the room coming up, I don't think we have any public comment.
Okay. Board to discussion.
Yeah, I'm kind of along the lines of what Kit said earlier, and I appreciate you guys giving another design option as well, but I just think it looks a lot better with that stone retaining wall. I would like to see a couple trees instead of shrubs. Is there a reason why it's heat privacy, or if they grow too big, you're going to lose your view?
We heard this for the first time. We don't have any problem with trees,
okay,
especially on the sides, right? Yes, but we do have a very strong preference to option A. My wife wants to talk about it, but we also want to build fast and move fast, right? So if you tell us the first option is a no, Then, and the second option is we would like to get an approval today. We really appreciate that. Thank you.
I personally don't mind planting multiple trees in the back of the house. I think it will add beauty and it will merge with the rest of the environment. If we could have option A, it would be more to our liking, and we don't mind planting trees if that's gonna, you know, help the house blend in with the surroundings. Or I just feel like that this retaining wall is taking away from the beauty of the house, and I just don't see how it fits with, you know,
can
the
you
house
put
is...
those renderings, south facing renderings, side by side?
I'm wondering if Greg would be able to do a split screen even right here, right now, and have those renderings side by side.
Yes. I don't know if I have the, well, let me give you one. Let me give it a shot.
Maybe reopen the same tab, you know, left and right.
Yeah, that looks better.
What I'm trying to say is that this house is a very elegant house, and this massive wall is just, it turns it into, in my mind, and I'm not an architect, but I'm just looking at it as, you know, like a simple person. It turns it, in my mind, into somewhat of a fortress. And I don't know that that's what Vail is all about.
Yeah.
Reminds me of a middle-aged fortress. So if I could not have that wall, I would be happier. And I'm happy to plant as many trees as you want me to plant.
I think my personal
can we see it
opinion,
again?
Yeah, can we see that again? So my personal feeling is that the base of the house with that wall in front of it on the south elevation enhances the remainder of the house rather than detracts from it. But it's a subjective thing. You understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying, and I agree that it is subjective, right? And I think our opinion is seemingly different from maybe you all. We do feel that option A is the more attractive approach, but to your point, it's subjective. And it's the reason we brought two options to you today, right? We heard your feedback last go around, and we wanted to be respectful of that. And we felt that the option A addressed it. But if you wanted to see us swing the pendulum all the way to a very grounded architecture, that's why we've presented option B today.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Inspiration Homes, the Telluride Beaver Dam, and the adjacent Potato Patch home kind of have, none of them have that open, it's all enclosed, you know?
That's so correct.
Yeah.
And they have the garage, the Telluride from the lower level. So, yeah, there's some, but you are correct.
I don't know. Maybe because I'm a woman.
I personally like. I agree with them, but I don't think it's the you know, at the end it's subjective. It's not the end of the world if we'll get the option A. My wife feels very strongly about it. I actually agree with her, but not to the point where if we're all on consensus, not to the point where we're going to have another delay. We really like to break ground this year if we'll be able this fall if we'll be able to make it.
Kit, you've asked a few times to see them side by side. I just wanted to see if you had any additional
thoughts.
Yeah, I mean,
thoughts. Yeah, I understand the argument. I just I think option B looks better, grounded, and maybe it's that those columns, if they weren't like a stone veneered column, they were like an actual some kind of column element. I don't know. Yeah, it is. It's very subjective. It just I don't know. That's what's tough with options. It's like that. That second option just looks better, so in my opinion. So, and it definitely looks like the more sturdy, stronger, timeless building. The other one, I don't know. I think it is. It's subjective, but I like option B. So,
I guess my request with that, I'm hearing you all say option B. If we were to move forward with that, would we be able to get conditional approval? That would be my request with option B being kind of the option.
So.
I'm good with
so.
It. Yeah.
Great.
All right. That okay? Well, do I have a motion?
Yeah, I'll move to approve DRB 25-0127 with the exception that you work with staff on ensuring that there's the option B retaining wall around it. So,
And that works as far as a condition. If you could also make a finding that it meets a certain section of town
it
as
meets
well.
Section 14.10.5, building materials and design, as well as 14.10.4, architectural projections, decks, balconies, steps, bay windows, etc.
You have a second?
I second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Next item on the agenda is DRB 250197, Rumford Residence. The planner is Greg Roy, and the applicant name is Thea Rumford Living Trust, represented by Moriello Planning Group.
Yes. Thank you very much. As you mentioned, we are looking at 675 Forest Road. So here is a quick aerial to give you an idea of where in town we are looking at. This is kind of up from the Eagle River Station on that north side of the road, 675 right here. As you can see, it is kind of a structure that has two main roof areas connected by a lower kind of patio roof in the middle. What is being requested today is to remove the wood shakes. So both of these roofs are wood shakes, and only replacing one of these roofs with a different material. They are looking to use an asphalt shingle. Generally, when it comes to town code, there are a couple of sections that look at, you know, replacement of roofs. We really look for them to be a consistent material across the structure, and that is kind of supported by 14.10.5, I believe B2, if I'm not mistaken. But really, what we have with these situations when we have a non-conforming roof, such as a wood shake, is that if the roofs don't share a ridge, they can have a different material. It just needs to be compatible. Generally, when we see a wood shake roof being removed, we see another synthetic shake kind of being put in place, which really kind of matches as far as the look of a real wood shake, but in a conforming material. What's being proposed today is an asphalt shingle versus any sort of synthetic wood shake. Staff felt that that really wasn't compatible. You know, you have a very asphalt shingles, while they do have, you know, different shingle looks, are very flat and doesn't have a lot of a three-dimensional kind of aspect to it, and can look quite different. So if there was, you know, if the application was to replace both, this probably would have been staff approved, or if it would have been to go to a synthetic shake material, probably would have been staff approved. But the fact that only one roof was going to be replaced with an asphalt shingle and leave the other one with a non-conforming wood shake shingle, we didn't think that that kind of met the criteria in order to be approved. The applicant wanted to bring it to the board to make their case in front of the three of you for this application to move forward. Here is kind of a look at the shake or the asphalt shingle that's being proposed. The applicant does have a presentation for you, so I won't go into too much because I'm sure they have plenty to say. But is there anything I can answer from a staff perspective before we move to their presentation?
Yeah, Greg, I just have one question. So it is, you said per the town of Vail code, as long as the ridges don't touch each other, it is viable to have two different type of roofing materials?
Yeah, if they don't share a ridge or a plane, they can have two different materials. The only qualifier is that they have to be compatible.
Why isn't the second roof, the second addition roof, being replaced?
We'll cover that.
That's probably a question best answered by the applicant.
All right, are you ready for us?
Go for it.
Okay. Hi, I'm Allison Kent with Moriello Planning Group. I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves.
I'm Heather Rumford Kehoe. I'm the daughter of the owner.
Dominic Moriello.
So just an overview kind of the neighborhood in the area. This is 675 West Forest Road. A blow up so you guys can really see how the house sits. It's actually two units. It's a two family unit. However, the owner owns both halves of this. She is a woman that is in her 90s, and there are two separate insurance policies on the house. So it has been in the Rumford family's ownership since the 1960s. In fact, the original home, which is the one you see in the picture here, was constructed in 1966. In the late 80s and the early 90s, that garage that you saw was built, and then right after that, a second unit was constructed on the property, so also in the 90s. This gives you kind of an idea about that. So it's the front one that is the original home, which is actually the south side, and then the northern unit, which was the one that was built in the 90s. I think that the 90s are the original cedar shakes that were put on when the house was built. So, you know, they're quite old at this point in time. Let's see if that unblurries there. It's actually really hard to get a full picture of both of the units. So you really only see the original home from West Forest Road. The other home sits quite a ways back. They're almost hard to ever view at the same time. We were standing in the driveway almost by the garage to get that one on the right side. So on that upper right, original home is on the right side and the 90s home is on the left side. The units have separate insurance policies, and one of the policies is requiring that the unit be re-roofed, just the original home be re-roofed. There's no remodel as part of this project. And the expense to replace both of the roofs just isn't in her budget right now. So again, we're requesting to re-roof the original home with asphalt shingles, and I did bring the sample in front of you guys. I know that kind of Gray's comment was about compatibility. It's really hard to get a picture of a roof, but we went out there and tried to hold the asphalt shingles at kind of the same angle that roof form sits at. It's a very simple gable roof. Nothing complicated about the roof form. And again, the town code does not require the second unit to be re-roofed. So here are the design guidelines that relate to this. You guys, we may be the first ones in front of you. I don't think we'll be the last. I think that a lot of insurance companies are saying you gotta replace your roof. So these are the design guidelines that relate to the Class A roof assemblies that are required by the town of Vail. And it clearly says that the use of concrete tile, slate, metal, asphalt shingle, fiberglass shingle, built-up tar and gravel roofing may be permitted. And it says asphalt shingles, when permitted, shall be designed to provide visual relief through texture, dimension, and depth of appearance. Wood shake, wood shingles are prohibited. Two-family dwelling units shall have uniform roof materials unless the design review board determines that the materials are compatible, are integral to the architectural style of the structure, and that different materials do not share any ridges or planes. There's also a section in the code that talks about non-conforming structures. This clearly allows different materials on each side of a two-family dwelling if the materials are deemed compatible, integral to the style, and share a valley or do not intersect. Again, just so you guys can start to see, you can see the age of those cedar shakes. I mean, I don't know how asphalt shingles would not be considered compatible with this. It's really hard to define compatible. I think Dominic said, are cats and dogs gonna start marrying? But I think generally, you see asphalt shingles on many homes on West Forest Road. You see a mix of roofing materials on West Forest Road. These structures really are pretty separate. You can see even from this graphic, all of the different roofing materials that are along West Forest Road. Even above that, you can see within Lion's Head all the different roofing materials. And I think that they're all compatible with each other. Talking about the integral to the architectural style of the home, these really are two separate units. They're only connected by a garage. That garage is flat roofed and is used as a terrace. And finally, that they share a valley or do not intersect. So they're allowed to have two different roofing materials if they share a valley. These do not even intersect. At the closest, they're 17 feet from each other. That's at the very closest. They sit at different angles. They read very much as separate structures. So, I just thought you might ask, when do you have to do both sides of it? It's only if two sides have roof systems that share ridges or planes. The town wants people to replace their cedar shake roofs. It is a desire of the town, the fire department. The design guidelines were amended fairly recently to allow two-family homes to have different roofing materials as long as they are Class A roofs. Asphalt shingles are listed as an allowable roofing material, and we believe that the proposal complies with the design guidelines. And just to note, the owner is willing to accept a condition that the other unit is roofed with the same material if it is required in the future. I did also just want to pull up, this is from the town's website talking about the risk of cedar shakes. I think we all know the benefit of eliminating the cedar shakes, so I didn't want to belabor the point, but I do just want to say that it is a goal to get these wood shakes off of homes. That's it. Thank you.
Questions? Not sure why you're even here.
We brought a team.
And you brought a team, too.
Yeah, and I think we're obviously for getting rid of the cedar, and I think the budget constraint is allowing just one of the homes at the time, so I'm okay with that. I'm sure it's really hard to match. I'm okay with that. But I do think you mentioned something, Allison, about if the other house does get re-roofed, it would be the same color.
And yeah. Yes, we would accept
that's
that.
That's my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Could we make that part of the approval?
Yeah.
Okay. Any public comment? None? Nobody online?
Well, we have two attendees online. If either of you wish to give comment, please raise your hand. Give them a few seconds to do so. And neither have their hand raised. Doesn't seem like we have any public comment. I mean, I guess less comments from the board. If there was a condition that the other roof be re-roofed with the same material in the future, that would need to be stated with the approval. Just one last thing from staff is that generally, you know, we would see something more of a synthetic shake going forward, but if the board thinks this is appropriate and compatible, we will take that into account when reviewing future applications as well, and you won't see anything like this again. So I'm happy to take that condition as well.
Okay. Do you have a motion?
Kit, are you spinning wheels over there?
Yeah, it doesn't look as good as a synthetic shake, right? What's the price difference?
Like three times.
It's massively different. I actually just spoke to a roofer yesterday who said prices are going up on DaVinci today.
So it would actually be more cost effective to do both homes at one than to just do one with a synthetic?
Slightly more cost effective. I would like to note, and you know, this home was built in the 1960s. If you drive down West Forest Road, almost every house along there has been demolished and rebuilt, you know, a new home. I think that is probably a redevelopment of this property would probably entail something similar to that in the future. So I don't think that there's, you know, putting that much investment into that property of this age would be a challenge.
Yeah, if we were doing a substantial remodel, somebody was coming here and getting this house, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah. Okay. I think in going forward in the future, Greg, this is a unique condition. And I don't think we should rubber stamp just changing to asphalt all the time because it's cost effective, but especially this is a prominent architectural feature of the house, but I do buy the argument that it's probably not going to be there for a long time, so.
Sadly, yes.
Noted.
Well, that's the way of that road, yeah. It's like, but
cool. Yeah, send it.
All right. I'll move to approve DRB 25-0197 with the findings it meets section 14-10-5, which is building materials and design.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next project is DRB 25-0112, Penzel Residence, final review of new construction. The planner is Heather Knight. The applicant name is Peter Penzel, represented by Unum Collaborative.
All right, thank you. So this is one of those rare vacant lots up on Garmisch. Quite a steep lot, as you can see in these photos here. I just wanted to start with the photos to see the challenges. Setbacks are also part of that challenge. The right-of-way actually comes in quite far. I'll go to a site plan here to kind of show. So the property line is actually way back here. So there's quite a bit of a setback that's required. So by the time you actually get to the point of building the home, it's set back quite into the slope of the lot. So with those challenges in mind, they have come up with their design for a single family home. Let me grab this other. I wanted to kind of go through some of the materials and kind of the basic architectural features, and then I'm going to hand it over to the architects that can probably explain things a little bit better than I can. But as you can see, because of the slope on this site, quite an extensive use of retaining walls. There is this prominent feature of this staircase that goes up on the side of the home, actually crosses over the property line and moves back, and that is actually approved by our Public Works Department to do that, so that is okay. I do want to note before I get too far along that we're still working out some of the review comments, so this is not for a final approval today. We're actually just going to give them some feedback on the design and discuss a few items and then come back when all of the departmental reviews have been or comments have been addressed. But in any event, it is a four-story home at given point here. Steps back into the site, retaining walls, stone all the way around. We'll kind of walk around this in a 3D perspective. But what I kind of wanted to hone the board in on was the use of materials and are they integrated into each other enough? Staff had some kind of questions on that because it looks very one material on one level, another material on another, a little bit of tie-in in the middle. So kind of we can maybe talk about that a little bit, just giving you some talking points, some ideas here, and talking about maybe adding some more landscaping to the front, although it does meet the landscape requirements to kind of soften this front elevation. So I'm going to make this a little bigger. Here's the materials that they've proposed. So it's a good variety of the natural materials along with the metals. So you've got the metal handrails or guardrails, the metal roof, zinc cladding on the kind of center portion, and stone again for the retaining walls and kind of that bottom to kind of ground the architecture, as well as vertical wood siding. So I'll skip through these pretty quickly and kind of walk around, and then I'll hand it over to the team here in front of us. So this is the front elevation. So stone, and I believe it's the zinc, and then the wood. Another perspective from the other side. You can kind of see the staircase and how that kind of goes up with the climbs with the site. This is the rear elevation, so you can see really how carved into the site this is, with retaining walls and patio off the back. And that's all I'm really going to go through at this point. Like I said, we're still working through our comments, progressing along just fine. I think we're almost there. And so if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I'll hand it over to the team. Good?
All right.
Okay.
Well, we'll start by introducing ourselves. We're Unum Collaborative. I'm Jim Pfeiffer. This is Levi Wall, and this is Brandon Sweeney, and our contractor's here, but he didn't want to come up here. So anyway, so let me start with some of the site things. And Heather, thank you. I think you've covered a lot of this. But I think there's two things that we want to make sure we cover before we start getting into some of the uses of materials and some of the things that I think appear to be present on here. And yeah, so the first thing is it's obviously a very steep slope. So that's one thing that we needed to deal with the stair specifically, and then also with how we tier, how we start to step this building back as we go up. The other thing is that it's a very narrow throat at the street. So, you know, this garage is going to be very, or the driveway is going to be dug out, and you're going to sort of have this flat area. But when you experience this on the street, it's really, what is that, 40 feet long or something like that? It's pretty thin. It starts to expand up as you go back up the hill. But yeah, the experience with the right of way is quite small. So next, I want to get into the materials a little bit. We use the materials here pretty deliberately. We wanted to use the materials to kind of express the house's relationship with the grade. So as you're in the grade, the stone material kind of represents that cut. So the retaining walls, that first floor plinth, that's all the stone. The second floor and sort of the tower element, that's the metal. And that's meant to sort of represent more of like a base. And the stone kind of wraps that a little bit, so it's more the middle. But you have that base on the second floor, and then that stair tower is sort of this representation of observation as you're looking out over the valley. And then as you go to the side, that wood starts to integrate more with the rest of the native site. So that's the justification for why those materials were selected. And then the stairs, we should talk about the stairs because I know they do come into the right-of-way and I know that they have been approved, but I think what we did here was do our best to create a staircase that went with the grade as naturally as possible and provided a way to actually get down onto that driveway surface. There's going to be a big cut here, so we've got a lot of grade to deal with from a vertical standpoint getting up onto that third floor. And I think the only other thing that I want to talk about is the water. So we are working with the Eagle River Sanitation District about getting pretty close to a water line that's over there. We've had conversation with them. We've done some test holes. So I think we've had a collaborative effort here in coming up with some details around how that is going to be treated and how maintenance in the future is going to be achievable without damaging either side. I think that's all I have. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Brandon? Okay. Yeah, that's, I think, all we have for the presentation. So any questions, we'd love to talk about it.
Actually, I will add. One of the things is, you know, Heather mentioned potentially having more landscaping at the front of the driveway. So this is one of the things that are in flux and we're working with the city on right now, the city staff. The driveway, as we initially showed it and is shown in this rendering, is actually too wide as it gets to the street. So there will be sort of an area right kind of to the right of that staircase that will be more natural, you know, landscape. So we can show that next time we meet with you all.
Any questions?
Yeah, but with respect to the staircase, is that, I see there's an elevator, but, and then obviously stairs on the inside. Is that just if you're hanging out on the third level and you want to go to the driveway, you just run down the stairs quick? Or is there a lock off at all on this property?
No, I think it's more about access from the driveway to the other levels. So you can also get to the second floor from that staircase.
There's also, you know, this is an unlikely scenario, but you accidentally lock yourself out on that patio and need to get down, you know, somewhere. So it is a component of egress as well.
Can you walk around the site again?
Yeah, I can rotate around and show us a little. And what are the black, are those reglets in the siding field? Those black lines?
So we've got a zinc panel that we're using. You're talking about the second floor?
In the wood field. Oh, in the wood. What are those, metal reglets, or what are those?
Those are reveals, basically, reglets, yeah. Basically just to try to add some rhythm with the mullions in the window system. And give ourselves an opportunity to break those up so we don't have butt joints on that material.
And what is the wood material? Are the boards going to be that small, actually, or is that kind of a rendering thing?
That's pretty close to accurate. So we're proposing 2x6 pressure-treated, fire-resistant vertical wood siding for that area. But that is representational of the overall size.
That's the south elevation, is it not?
So that's the elevation that faces the road, so it's technically the west elevation. East, yeah, yeah.
East elevation, okay. Okay, can you rotate around the house?
Yeah. This is the southeast corner. It's sitting on the patio. This is to the west.
Yeah. So the design guidelines specifically state that project should be respectful of the site. And in my opinion, what you have here is not very respectful of the site. That's just my opinion. Do you have any comments on
that? There are a lot of retaining walls, I suppose. Can we keep going through the images a little bit?
Let's see. Those are all of our renderings. Were there other images you want to see, or do you want to kind of rewind?
Yeah, just so we can see what's going on. I think what's going on with the second level and the stone is that it's turning the corner and then turning to the zinc panels.
Yeah, you mean on the flanking sides of the stone?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have the stone interacting with the ground. The zinc really doesn't interact with the ground anywhere.
That's so that white colored material.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And is the same thing happening on the opposite side?
Yeah. So in regard to the respect of the site, are you just talking about the amount of cut?
The amount of cuts and the amount of retaining walls on that backside. I mean, the scheme would be destroyed if you didn't do it, this particular scheme. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's another scheme that you've looked at that perhaps is a little bit more site friendly.
We haven't, no. So I will say one of the things is we inherited this project from Michael Hazard Architects. My understanding was that this had gone through an initial review board review. And a lot of these retaining walls did come from that original design. So we didn't even think about reviewing that because we had thought that it was already sort of got the...
What did you think about reviewing?
What was that?
What did you think about reviewing, if not the...
It was a lot of materials. That stair was a big thing. We redesigned the stair that was in there.
Building massing and roofing.
The roofing, yeah. The roof lines, yeah.
I do think it's a nice house.
A question on that, too, is in determining appropriateness to the site, how do you guys look at precedence in terms of other houses in Vail or other developments in Vail and kind of similar approaches?
Well, if the precedence and the other house is bad, don't show it. Well, are you suggesting that there are other houses that have this deep cut in the land? I mean, you're going to dig a big hole on that. To build this house, and I can't see where you have any choice, actually.
It's a challenging site. I think this is one of the reasons that it's one of the only vacant lots there.
Yeah.
So
it's very, very steep.
Yeah.
Hey, Jim, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
This is Peter Penzel. How you doing, sir?
This is the owner.
Hi, Peter.
I don't know if you guys can see me. My camera's on, but I...
No, we're looking at the rendering, Peter.
Oh, okay. I went through several iterations with Mike Hazard years and years ago. There is no way, because of the 44-degree angle on the site, to get back into the site without digging a big hole. And I didn't like the amount of retaining walls either, but there's no way around it because the retaining wall restriction is 6 foot high per wall. So there was no way to get into the actual lot, reach this driveway requirements for parking, and then have a front door without you having three tiers of walls on the side as you enter to the right, and then you end up with the same thing in the back if you try and create any type of tiny little space for a deck or a hot tub. We had one version where we had two retaining walls, and Michael knew someone in the town and had it reviewed, and they said that we needed three because we were just cutting in too much. It's a very challenging site.
Can you put up a picture of the rear
yeah,
yard?
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, and I think that is a good thing, Peter, that you're bringing up.
It's a bad
up.
Point, yeah.
Just in terms of, you know, there is the 6 foot requirement for retaining walls, and then if you have a successive one, you know, you need to kind of push it back a little bit. So you kind of, it's a little bit of a catch 22.
I might be able to help with a little more context too on the site in general. As Peter mentioned, this was kind of the site has had a previous application before. It did come to the DRB for a conceptual review and then went to Planning Commission. They were asking for a variance for the amount of site coverage. One of the challenging thing with these smaller lots is the site coverage requirement to be able to meet that. As well as Peter mentioned, the parking, because this one is so far from the road, they do have to back the house into the hillside in order to have enough room to fit the required parking spaces in the garage and in the driveway in front, which is required to be on their property. I think, Herb, probably what you're seeing or what you're referring to with some of the retaining walls is the desire to have that outdoor space on that lower level on the back side. If we think about the last application, there really wasn't as many retaining walls along the building. It was kind of tucked into the hillside itself, and that was due to the fact that they didn't have that outdoor entertaining space. So I think that's a little bit probably the context of where the application's been, as well as the challenges and kind of what's driving maybe a portion of those walls.
That and the house was farther forward, and the house was not compliant with the parking.
Right, exactly.
So the second you put the parking, it's like a chicken and egg. Mm-hmm. The second you get the parking compliant, the house is so far back that you end up with this series of retaining walls, no matter how you do it.
Yep, certainly a challenge.
I'm sorry, Greg, did you say you did, or Mr. Pennsville did apply for a variance on parking or not?
I believe it was a site coverage. I'd have to go back. I'm just kind of going off memory here. I know site coverage was part of it. I'm not sure if parking was as well.
That was a previous
application.
Yeah,
previous application a couple of years back.
Peter.
In this particular design, they do meet the requirements for parking,
yeah,
as well as site coverage.
And the renderings don't necessarily reflect the amount of landscaping that we have planned. There's I worked with a landscape architect to heavily landscape all the beds that are in the retaining walls to try and take away from the walls, just because there's so many of them. So I feel like we can mitigate the curb appeal or lack of curb appeal with the walls by heavily landscaping in each of the beds. And as Levi had mentioned, the rendering displays an incorrect amount of driveway. So the correct amount of driveway will also give us an opportunity to plant some ornamentals, maybe an ornamental tree, lots of plantings.
Were you about to say something with Rob?
I was gonna just confirm that there are three major materials. There's the wood, the zinc, and the stone.
Correct.
And that continues all the way around.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And do you guys know the length of the driveway? I know, I thought you mentioned it right away. I can't see quite, it's not long at all, right?
No.
Okay.
Well, is there any public comment?
27 feet.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to suggest shifting the house forward, but I'm sure you guys looked at that.
So, yeah, this is the line here.
We're as far forward as we can be.
I figured.
Yeah. For the setback. And they've encroached over that because at that point, the garage can, because it's a steep slope, it can go into the setback. Okay. At one story, so that's why the building itself steps back.
The landscape plan, DRB 07, if you zoom in on the site portion of it, that's a real good visualization of how deep the driveway is and what the size of it is and the approach to the house. And
so it's helpful, I guess going back to that photo of the site. So if you see the distance.
Hey, do you mind speaking in the mic? Sorry.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Just for the online.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so if you see that site plan, you see the edge of the road, and then you see the property line all the way back from there. And then, Heather, if you'd go back to that, the photos of the existing, actually up a couple more. Yeah, so that photo on the top right, so that's the edge of the road. So the property line is actually, I don't know how many feet up already, right? So again, that's some of the necessity of pushing into the grade is just how quickly it goes up. Yeah.
Well, we have a motion.
Oh no, we have that's comments. Just a, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no motion today. It's just.
Just
some,
conceptual?
Right. Well, we have some review comments to. Okay.
Well, I think if we go back to the rendering, we usually don't prefer if you don't transition materials in the same plane. So that's usually need at least a 6-inch offset.
We do have an offset there. So if 6 inches is the answer, I want to say that's 4 inches. I mean, it's we did make sure we don't want to do that either. Yeah, okay. So.
Is that the zinc to the stone?
I personally think that would look better if that zinc wrapped the corner instead of just having that 6 inches or whatever of stone, 8 inches of stone.
So on the right side, we've got that retaining wall coming into it. So it's kind of, we're forced to do that stone move on the right. And then if you look on the left, as you go up the side, that becomes an interaction with the grade. So as opposed to having the zinc interact with the grade and kind of breaking the concept of our materials. And then obviously we don't want an outside corner transition between those two materials. That little bit of stone on the front kind of gives that stone weight. So it allows us to make that transition. And I know
I don't think that looks good, so.
So would you suggest bringing the zinc all the way back to the deck?
We prefer that the materials transition at an interior corner and not in the same plane, right? I just think that looks, I would return it there, yeah, correct.
So you'd want to wrap it around that front corner on the left side of the house and bring it all the way?
I would, instead of just having that small field of stone. it would look better. And that would be more consistent with what we record. That's just one of our things, right? That's the design review board standards.
Yeah.
And then what about the right side where you've got that retaining wall coming in?
That's not as bad, in my opinion, as long as you can have a 6-inch depth of field transition so it doesn't look like the zinc's dying in with the stone. I think that's fine. That's all I have, and otherwise I think it looks good. So.
Yeah. What about the on the third level? There's an outdoor little grilling area. The wall that composes that is made of the same stone as the retaining walls. Is that okay?
I think that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fine.
And you guys are good with the massing of the stair column in zinc? And same on the backside to try and.
Yeah, I think that element's cool how it goes through the house and come you pick it up on the backside. And you got some zinc on that lower level. Because one of the concerns was the layer cake look. It's like, so just anyways, you can break those the materials across the elevations of the floors. I think it helps a lot. And you guys are on the right track. We'll see this again, though. Mm-hmm. So I look forward to seeing it.
And you're a fan of the riglet-ing to break up the wood?
Yeah, that's cool.
The heat-modified wood?
Yeah, if you give us a little more detail on what the profile is and kind of, sure. I like it.
Is there anything here that's not going to be approvable on the next go-around, aside from the couple things that we just talked about? Mostly the retaining. I want to make sure that we're not coming in here and, you know, having the same conversation and kind of having to go back and redesign.
No, I'm not seeing anything. No. Yeah, just you make sure the materials track and terminate at logical places, and
they are compatible. So
yeah, I like mm-hmm. the material palette's great, right? And
perfect. Kit, question for you. You had asked about the width of the boards. What I think is rendered as a 2x6. Would you guys rather see a 2x8, a wider board plank?
I just wasn't sure if that was a kind of a if it was a rendering thing where it's just appearing smaller. Is this a thermary kind of wood?
Similar.
Yeah, no, I that's a cool product and it looks great, performs well, and the board size is up to you. I wasn't sure. Sometimes the renderings, the boards, they look a little small in the rendering.
Right.
I think it's your preference for sure. So
I'm open, so easy there, but just wasn't sure if there was a preference from the board's perspective.
No, the renderings are tricky. Sometimes those materials don't always, you know, it's interpretive. So I think it looks good. So
great. Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate thanks,
it.
Guys.
You.
Appreciate it. You do need a motion to table this to a future date.
Thanks, Greg.
You want to do it?
Go ahead.
Propose a motion to table DRB 25-0112 to the next meeting or to the next available meeting, or
we can just put to a future date.
To
a future date.
Okay. I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, should we adjourn?
No, we have a bonus segment. Oh.
Yes, we should have Paul Kada in the room. He's going to do a quick presentation for you on their efforts with the Fire-Free 5. We'll turn over to Paul, and I believe he's got a presentation for you as well.
Mark's here, too. record, Mark Novak. What am I?
Fire Chief.
Fire Chief. Del Fire. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, thank you for the opportunity. The reason for our visit today is to update you on our current efforts to create a mandatory requirement for the Fire-Free 5 throughout the town of Vail. And while we're not looking for any action from the DRB, this regulation would sit outside of your scope. We do value the opportunity to hear, to present the concept and then to hear your input as well. So that's why we're here. All right. So first of all, some of you may remember we proposed Fire-Free 5 several years ago, and what Fire-Free 5 is a 5-foot non-combustible zone around all structures. And one of the big things that's changed in the last several years since we first discussed this is not only the fact that we're seeing more destructive fires, everybody's seen the headlines, but we're really starting to see kind of a crisis in insurance that's directly tied to wildfire. And so when we look at some of the headlines are on these slides, we see that insurance is becoming, a major impediment to home ownership. It's also starting to impact municipalities and their ability to generate funds through the impact on property taxes, impacting the real estate market and impacting the bond market as well. So starting to see these second order impacts. So when we look at, and I need to put my glasses on, excuse me. What we see happening is an insurance crisis related to wildfire. And we're seeing that wildfires are creating more costly insurance. I just saw today that in California, as a direct result of the Eaton and Palisades fire, State Farm is increasing rates 30%. High insurance costs lead to underinsured homes and in some cases non-insured homes. And across the US, we're now approaching 20% of all homes are uninsured, which has a real impact when we have loss. So in that situation, when people are underinsured or non-insured, there's a problem with recovering from disasters. And then without insurance, of course, for the people who are buying homes and getting a mortgage, they can't get a mortgage, so that starts to impact one of two things, either the ability to get a mortgage and get a home, and that impacts the real estate market, or it can lead to a situation where cash buyers who maybe aren't looking to make it their home are coming in and buying the homes out from underneath the folks who would live in the community and create that sense of community. So, why is this happening? I'm sure you've all seen slides like this before. Really we've seen this radical change in the fire environment since the year 2000 or about that time. And we know that all the largest fires in the history of Colorado have occurred since the year 2000. With really the four of the five largest fires happening since 2020. And what I really want to leave you with before we jump to the next slide, thanks, Paul, is that, sometimes we hear these comments that, why are we proposing changes in Vail? Our community was built a certain way. We appreciate a certain aesthetic, and that aesthetic has to do with a lot of vegetation, a lot of trees. And what we're seeing and what we know now is that the things that we did in 1964 when Vail was created were perfectly appropriate for our environment at that time, and they're completely inappropriate for the fire environment today. So next slide, please. So, and what we know now is that just really a very small amount of the fires, about 3% of all the fires are causing 88% of all the damage, and these 3% of the fires that are occurring are very fast fires. They're traveling very fast, they're growing very rapidly. And we know that since the year 2000, the speed at which fire grows has increased by 248%. And that's from a study from Dr. Jennifer Balch at CU Boulder. So that is not just a California statistic. California's number is closer to 400%, but that's across the nation. And we look at the fires that are really causing mass damage in our communities. They don't actually, we talked a minute ago about these really large fires, but they don't have to be large fires to be destructive. The Marshall Fire was a 6,000-acre fire, which is really a pretty small fire. It burned 1,000 structures and was a $2 billion loss. That's a direct loss. There's obviously second-order and third-order impacts that are much greater than that. And then Lahaina was a 2,000-acre fire that burned 2,200 structures, and there was a $6 billion loss. So that's kind of, things are changing, and we need to be really aware that, it doesn't have to be a large fire to really cause mass damage, especially in a community like Vail, where very similarly to the Marshall Fire and the Lahaina Fire, we have lots of structures that are very close together, and so we're very susceptible to not only having a wildfire enter our community, but then start burning structure to structure to structure, where we see a lot of loss. Next slide. The other thing that's really important to note is that we're seeing this transition, and again, a moment ago I spoke about what our conditions were in 1964 and what was appropriate, and we know that in the last couple of decades, the occurrence of fires is marching to higher and higher elevations. And so in fact, since the year 2000, the greatest relative increase in acres burned has occurred at elevations above 8,000 feet, which of course is very representative of Vail. And we're seeing things like fires jump the Continental Divide, jump the Sierra. So we're seeing fires occur in places where historically they wouldn't have. And again, you know, we don't have a lot of fire history in Vail in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s. So we have this changing condition. And then this slide, really what this is to illustrate, you know, the smokestack in the background kind of makes it look like it's in like Russia or somewhere, but this is Lahaina. And the reason we put this slide in the deck or this picture is that a lot of times people think about fire risk as really just about homes. And you know, obviously we have a high focus on homes, but in these fires that we're seeing in the last decade, we're seeing a lot of commercial loss and we're seeing a lot of loss of multifamily units. And you know, I think that's important to recognize because frequently we hear, okay, we get that we need to mitigate our home, but we don't really need to worry about Vail Village burning, do we? And in fact, you know, there's really no type of occupancy unless it's, you know, truly like class one construction that's completely resistant to fire. So, and then the other thing that's important about this is we start to build a lot of high occupancy and multifamily buildings. You know, the other issue is that wildfire is truly a housing issue. And if we were to lose even 100 housing units, just, you know, imagine the impact on our community of displacing 100 families. You know, where would they go? We'd probably lose those families forever. That's what we see in a lot of these other fires. They never come back to the community. There's no housing to house the workers that are necessary to rebuild those units. And so you have this kind of magnifier in loss in achieving housing goals and achieving community goals. So, you know, the reason we're having this discussion now, you know, it's a hard discussion. People, you know, they're resistant to being told what to do on their property. But we're at a point where we really need to make some tough choices. And, you know, the first thing is that you know, a lot of people say, well, we don't have to worry about this because we have a great fire department. And yes, you do have a great fire department. But we don't have the resources available to suppress our way out of fires. You know, we rely heavily on the National Cohesive Wildfire Management Strategy, which talks about resilient landscapes, meaning we treat the areas around the community, fire-adapted communities where we do mitigations around the home like Fire-Free 5, and we have good fire suppression. It's not an or proposition. We need to have all three of those in place. And certainly if a place like Los Angeles, where, you know, in any given day within about a 30-mile radius, there's probably on the order of about 300 engine companies staffed, fire engine staffed. And in, you know, think about Eagle County, there's 10 fire engines staffed on a daily basis. So, so fire suppression is not our way out of the WUBI problem. The second thing is we can't price our way through insurance out of our WUBI problem. So just saying, okay, we're going to live with higher insurance rates is not a way to solve the problem. We really need that interplay of insurance and the wildfire risk to help motivate people to take action. And then lastly, we collectively, you know, governments, fire departments, citizens in the community, we haven't collectively demonstrated our willingness to regulate our way out of our WUI problem. And really, you know, this is about shared risk. And you know, the reason we need regulation, I've worked in several different communities, and you know, we always talk about education first, and education works great. Usually at the best you get about 20% engagement through education. Maybe then you start to add some economic incentive through grant programs and you get maybe another 10, maybe if you're really lucky, another 20% of people on board. But I've never seen above 50% compliance with wildfire regulations without a mandatory ordinance. And the reason this is really important, especially in a community where our homes are close together, is that you know, if I mitigate my home and I live next to Paul and he doesn't mitigate his home, or maybe he's even three doors down, that fire that ignites his home is gonna burn my home down. So this is truly a shared risk proposition that we need to have a collective approach to, and we need to mitigate at scale.
So to tag on to that, in 2020, the town adopted its first community wildfire protection plan. As part of that planning process, we actually studied things like how close our structures are built together. That's the photo that you, or the image that you see on the slide here. You can see that those images in red are buildings that are less than 30 feet apart, which is the majority of structures within this community. What we know, why that's significant, is that is a critical threshold where we talk about If one structure burns, the likelihood of the next one to burn is very high. So over 80% of our buildings are built within 30 feet of the nearest building. So, you know, that really demonstrates how connected our risk is within this community. Over the last really 8 years, we've done a pretty aggressive approach at educating our community members on what their specific wildfire risk is at their property. Starting in 2017 and continuing today, we do annual curbside wildfire hazard assessments where we go through and we look at what are those specific hazards to each property. We share that information with the residents, and that's really where we identified the fire-free five as one of the biggest issues here within the community. We have incorporated fire-free five into our building and planning regulations. As you guys are aware, there is the requirements for defensible space and ignition resistant building materials on all new construction, exterior modifications, all of that. What we're looking at here is how do we address those buildings that are not going through the development process. You know, to give you a picture of the problem, in our first round of assessments between 2017 and 2021, 79% of the properties did not have a compliant fire-free five. Last year, we completed 559 assessments. That was the Eastvale area. Of those, 84 of those properties had at least one issue within the fire-free five. So we know that this is a prevalent problem across the town. So, you know, what do we see out in the community? You know, what we see here on the slide, this is what we're seeing. You know, really it's small vegetation within that first 5 feet. I would say a good portion of the properties have shrubs, you know, foundation planting of shrubs. You know, some buildings have lack of maintenance. And really the big one that we see, the trees. We have lots of trees. You know, there was points during the planning in this town where there was lots of trees required to be planted very close to buildings. Many of those have grown up over 30 years, and what was a cute, nice little spruce tree 30 years ago is now a very large tree that's grown up into the building. And so, you know, without a doubt, there's work to be done here. So what our standards are in the fire-free five. So really we allow five things in there. Hardscaping, so patios, driveways, walkways, all that kind of stuff. Non-combustible mulch, or AKA some version of rock. So cobble, small stone. Well irrigated and maintained lawn works within there. And then we also allow perennial flower beds and perennial ground covers. To help our community members understand and envision what this looks like, we've actually developed a fire-free five landscaping guide with Greg Berry, and that's been out and available for a couple years on the town's webpage. How do we address the trees? That's really the biggest question. In all of our outreach and education and our community events, you know, people want to know, how do we address trees? You know, there's really two ways to address trees within the first 5 feet. One option is to remove it, and in some cases that's the best option. In other cases, and I think this is a pretty good example right here, where you have this large spruce tree that, you know, was planted. I would say that stem is probably 8-10 feet off the foundation of that building. Over the years it's grown as trees do, and it is grown into that building. So an acceptable way to mitigate the risk, and this does not remove the risk, but it reduces the risk pretty significantly, is to do some pruning on that tree. So in that case, we're going to want to remove the bottom 6 feet of the tree, so branches off the bottom 6 feet, create a 5-foot horizontal separation between the nearest branch and the tree, and then stop that 10 feet over the roof line. So in essence, we're talking about pruning out that L shape. You know, another question people often ask is, you know, does that make an unhealthy tree? And the professional standard is, as long as you don't remove more than a third of the total crown of the tree, the tree will survive just fine. Fire-free five also addresses other things, other combustible materials within that first 5 feet. So, you know, oftentimes this is a place where people store firewood and other things like that. And so, you know, we want to also address that because that is a major fire concern. So really our stance on that is either remove it or enclose it in a way that it can't combust. So, you know, a common way of doing that is like enclosing it in metal boxes or things like that. One of the things that we recognize is that we have a lot of vegetation within the first 5 feet. Some of it is highly combustible, others is maybe less. And so we do feel that there's an important step in all of this in looking at, is there vegetation that we can exempt from this? And so as part of our proposal, we're looking at a way to provide exemptions for existing vegetation. And I think that's really important is that this covers the existing vegetation, not new things. As properties go through the development process, you know, we'll still want to apply the codes that are currently adopted. But what we're proposing is evaluating vegetation for exemption that is deciduous, it's well-maintained, healthy, doesn't have any combustible plants or mulch below it, and adjacent to structures that have non-combustible siding, which there are plenty of within this community, and not within 5 feet of openings of vents, doors, windows, which is really the most vulnerable part in the structure. So, you know, a lot of people envision Fire-Free 5 as this stark landscape next to the building. And, you know, these photos come actually out of that landscaping guide. And these are all examples of compliant landscaping within the town of Vail. That I think are fairly attractive. There's a pretty good way that we can mix hardscaping, landscaping, and maintain the aesthetics that are important in the community. Another question that's often brought up in this is, so what does this cost? Over the last 4 years, or 3 years, we've been running the Fire-Free 5 Community Assistance Program. And, you know, we've funded nearly 100 projects, actually just over 100 projects in this. And, you know, it's given us a pretty good snapshot of what this costs, how to, you know, to convert landscaping within the town of Vail. And you can see on there breakout by property type. So, you know, we're looking at, for single families, just under $4,000, half of a duplex, $2,500. You know, the smaller multifamily units are around 7,000, and the larger multifamilies are, you know, around 13,000. And, you know, costs vary widely, as would be expected. The most expensive part of this is if people are converting to, you know, non-combustible mulch. You know, the more durable landscape changes tend to be far more expensive. However, the long-term maintenance becomes much cheaper. So, you know, cost is real on this. We do have the Fire-Free 5 Community Assistance Program. This year we have $100,000 available in funding, and, you know, that is available to all community members to do this on a voluntary basis. So the last slide that I want to cover is just kind of what the proposal is for the implementation process. So what we're working on right now, and our goal would be to adopt changes to Chapter 11, Title 5, which is the Dead Tree and Wildfire Abatement Code. So it's the same code that dead trees fall under. So we would look to put these requirements within that code section. We would adopt that this year and then utilize a 3-year compliance phase for property owners to comply with the new regulation, recognizing that it's going to take time for people to make modifications to their landscaping. During that time, we're going to provide updated hazard assessments and targeted outreach to each individual property owner, and then really have a very robust outreach and education program. Following that compliance phase, beginning in the summer of 2029, we'd begin enforcement of that. And because, you know, landscape grows, changes, property owners change, people put things in there, reinspection and maintenance is a super critical part of this. So, you know, the intention on this is that each property would be reevaluated every 3 years to ensure that that compliance is maintained. And if necessary, we'd be able to enforce corrective action at that time. So
we appreciate the opportunity to come before you. Again, this isn't going to fall under one of the titles of the town code that's under the DRB. However, we think it's really important to have your feedback And also, as we talk to folks, you know, one of the first things we hear is, well, what's the DRB going to say? So, you know, and of course, today, if a new project comes in, they are complying with Fire-Free 5. And I think, you know, you folks are seeing that it's a, we're able to create good-looking projects, good-looking landscape, and still protect our community. So we would love to hear your input. But before I go to that, I do want to mention that we have lots of public engagement opportunities coming up if you're talking to folks. Both community picnics this year, we'll be discussing Fire-Free 5. We have a public event here on July 10th at 4:30, and then we have a virtual event on July 14th at 10 in the morning. So if folks have questions, you know, really what we really want to do is talk to people, because what we found in the past is that people, you know, they hear Fire-Free 5 and they say, oh, we're going to have to cut all the trees down. We're going to put in, you know, red lava rock and lots of cactus. And we know that's not the case. And so having the opportunity to talk to folks is really, really important to us. So again, encourage you to share that with folks, and then love to hear your questions, comments, and take that as we move forward.
Can I start?
Yeah.
So I live along Bighorn Road in East Vale, and I've looked at that topography now since the fire in Boulder and Superior. And I could see how horrendous that would be if, God forbid, there would be a fire that broke out there. So I'm all in favor of following the regulations and following the rules that would make it a safer and less expensive to insure property. My concern is that there should be, well, maybe it's not a concern, it's a suggestion, that when a tree that's been like 30, 40 years old is within that burn zone, within that 5 feet, and gets cut down, often that's all that happens, is the tree is removed, and there's no requirement of the owner to come back to the DRB and say, okay, here's my new landscaping plan that will somehow soften the fact that the tree was removed. And that's occurred in my house. I live at the Racquet Club, so you're sure. Probably aware of that. Yeah. The other thing I'd like to follow up on, as you said that there's no way I can leave my firewood 30 feet away. So I do have an alcove that's covered on three sides by stone, and what you're saying is you can develop a plan to make that into an open air kind of, maybe a non-heated or non-cooled area that would protect the firewood from flames. Is that right?
So yeah, really each property is kind of unique, but we have definitely worked with property owners here within in the community on solutions to enclose their firewood in a way that is non-combustible. We've done stuff, you know, custom metal enclosures. Really, the whole point on that is creating a space where embers just can't become entrapped.
Okay.
And so that's really the most important part of that. The other side of that is timing can be really useful from a firewood perspective. You know, oftentimes you see people who accumulate firewood for multiple seasons on their deck. They have far more than they ever burn in any 1 year. And so another recommendation that we have is that, you know, when there's snow on the ground, our fire risk, I won't say it's zero, but it's pretty low, right? During that time, having firewood on the deck is a fairly low risk operation. When we hit April and the snow goes away, that's when our, you know, fire danger goes up, and that's the time when the firewood needs to go. And so there are also, you know, HOAs within the community who, you know, in October, they have their firewood contractor come in and stack up the wood. In April, whatever's left in there comes off the deck, and you know they'll do it again in October. Okay. So that's another way of mitigating that risk.
So does the town have, and this is a rhetorical question maybe, does the town have a procedure where they review areas where trees have been removed and combustible material has been removed from the face of the residence? Does the town have a requirement to go before the design review board and have the owner of that house say, okay, I don't have the trees here, but I'd like that. I'd like it to look good.
Sure.
And this is what I'm proposing.
Sure. So in the currently, we have a non-reviewable tree removal permit that the fire department issues for dead trees and for defensible space stuff. We do evaluate when we're out looking at properties for defensible space. We're looking at, you know, does this property require, you know, or have the ability to, you know, do modified landscaping? And I would say in most properties that I look at, you know, we're looking at trees that are right up against the building. Yeah. There are lots of other trees on the property as well. The place where this gets a lot more, you know, covered by regulations is within the, you know, the village cores. There is a no net loss of landscaping. So when we're talking about tree removals in those kind of areas, I work with the planning staff very closely on how to address the landscaping in those places. Okay.
Talk to Steve Loftus, you know him.
I do, yep. Yep.
He cut down a tree right in front of my house and it just looks horrible.
Sure.
It's a stump, you know, 1 foot off the ground and no ground cover, and I don't know whether they'll ever do anything that'll make it. It's certainly not going to be a big tree, but it would be nice if it was pleasant to look at.
Sure.
Anyway.
I just had a question on one of the stats you posted. Was you said, I think, 2017 to 2021, you guys came in and looked at every building in the
yep.
town. And then you don't need to pull it up or anything.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And then you went back in 2024, which was, yeah, a significant time period, but not that long.
Yep.
And 84% had a, was it?
So let me explain.
I was just curious to what was the majority theme? Was it like the trees grew back
sure.
and now they're in danger, or is some janky car park next to it? And that's
so the first stat is townwide. So townwide, 79%. We know in that time, Eastvale was bad. So what's showing in that, what we assessed last year was just strictly Eastvale. So that's not the full picture of the mm-hmm. town of Vail. I know there's some areas in the town of Vail that are far better. You know, the most common things that we're seeing, you know, we saw lots of places, you know, we assessed Eastvale in 2018. We assessed it again in 2024. I can compare those two assessments. There's a lot of properties where nothing changed in that time. There are plenty of properties where stuff did happen. But, you know, maintenance is a big part of this one. And, you know, this is one of the things with all the town buildings. You know, I work with Greg Berry. We went through and did fire-free five on every single building, including this one. It requires annual maintenance as well. You know, and so if you look right behind, you know, the building right here, there's stone and the grass is starting to grow back into the stone. So one of the things Greg and I are working on right now is how do we get rid of the grass that's growing back into the stone? So, you know, that's what we're seeing out on the, you know, on the ground as well.
So just lack of continued maintenance
yep.
was the main yeah. reason why it's 84%.
Yeah, one other reason there's a need for an ordinance or regulation is, as you all are aware, when a new project goes in, you review the landscaping, and Paul reviews the landscaping as well to make sure it's compliant. In the town, there's a requirement to remove a permit requirement to remove vegetation, especially trees. There's no permit requirement to add vegetation. And so there are cases where projects get completed, landscape gets installed, and they say, okay, we got signed off, now let's put in what we really want. And so this ordinance allows us to look, you know, kind of have a maintenance inspection going forward and address those issues.
Yep. Yeah, and one of the things, you know, even if it's not immediately after, change in ownership, you know, we see this pretty regularly. The original owner that built it understood why they did the landscaping. The new owner buys it, and they want something changed, right? And again, you know, to that point, there is no permit process for adding landscaping. And what we see added sometimes is atrocious from a fire perspective.
Do you guys get involved with preparing escape routes? Because we've talked about that sure. as a family. We've talked about that. What are we going to do if there's a fire? Do we just run up the slope to I-70?
Sure. Well, so we just this last year, we revised our evacuation plan for the town. And although it's for all different types of risk, it really is very specific to wildfire. And without spending a lot of time reviewing the whole plan, You know, that new plan talks a lot about, you know, where you would evacuate to. We've placed a lot of emphasis, again, learning from places like Paradise, California, Palisades, Eaton. You know, you might have famously seen, you know, bulldozers pushing cars out of the way.
Yeah.
So we've shifted our approach a little bit to, rather than having police officers knock on doors, having them make sure that traffic keeps flowing. But that puts a lot of responsibility on the individual to make sure that they're registered for our alerting system, EC Alert. We're also working on some alternative evacuation routes so that cars don't have to go through roundabouts. We know that roundabouts work pretty well under normal circumstances, and I'm sure you've all seen when there's closures on the interstate, once they stop working, they don't work at all. And so we're actually working on plans to develop emergency on-ramps onto the interstate so people don't have to go through roundabouts. So I'd encourage you to look at VailGov/EVAC that has our new plan, and that's being updated now. We're happy to come out and, you know, like the Racquet Club's a great community. We'd love to come out and speak to and present specifically on evacuation. But again, like with most everything else we do, you know, emergency services has a role, but ultimately the individual's preparedness is the biggest, you know, biggest determinant in how well things will go. So I encourage you all to take a look there. And again, we're happy to come out and speak to whatever groups about evacuation. But we think that the new evacuation plan is really robust. It's really been based upon learning that's been done from some really tragic evacuations where, you know, people died. So that's where we're at with evacuations.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, guys. Yeah, it's very informative.
Yeah, appreciate the time. And again, really would ask, you know, if people have questions that you can't answer, please direct them to us. You know, that's what we want to do is talk to people. And we're very happy to go out and look at their property and explain, hey, this is what Fire Free 5 would mean, because a lot of people have this notion in their head that it's, you know, like this crazy change in their landscape. In most cases, it's not.
So that's really great. That just eliminates the questions too, and have you guys come out. That's awesome.
We're available 7 days a week.
To that. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
I believe that's it on our agenda. So, adjourn.
Pose a motion to adjourn. Yeah.
Yes. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Sorry. Aye.